consider the problem which Michael and the creative spirit faced when they came out here 400 billion years ago. They've got, let's say they had a dozen nebulae to play with. Some of them were much bigger than Andromeda. They're not moving in exactly the right direction. They gotta be whipped in line. This is like wild horses that have to be harness broken. You see, the physical side is given a head start. And then, supervisors come out here that start to make cosmos out of chaos. That's a little overblown, that statement. But it says what I'm trying to say. Give me a little poetic license, though. The whole job, briefly, the whole drama in time and space is this. With material, energy, and matter being given a head start, can you whip it in line with mind? Because mind can whip matter in the long run. You don't do it by prayer, we do it by building machinery. We can control a lot through our construction of mechanical devices. Then, if this be personal mind, where you've got the priceless power of choice, will that creature choose to subordinate mind to spirit? So that spirit becomes the dominating factor, the directing factor in all growth. This is optional. You do have freedom of choice. You don't have to make this choice. Let me put that in a more familiar language of the papers. In time and space, energy matter is dominant, save in personality, where spirit, through the mediation of mind, is striving for the mastery. Spirit can't whip mass and energy. Spirit doesn't touch it. Matter is non-reactive to spirit, but mind is reactive to both. In the long run, mind will whip matter in any context, because mind can think and matter can't. Matter reacts. And mind can respond to spirit direction, but will do so only if the choosing personality so chooses. The world's religions have always wanted to have a contest. And just like Ogwalla, it's so easy to have a devil to fight. Perhaps the best illustration of that I know of is in Zoroastrianism. And if you want to know where we get our concepts, read the Zoroastrian account of the Day of Judgment, and you will be shocked to discover how Christian it is. And since it's 600 years older, you know who borrowed from who. Zoroaster presented a very challenging religion. He had, on the one hand, Ahura Mazda, the god of light. We get our name Mazda Light from that. And on the other hand, he had Ahriman, the Lord of Darkness. In eternity, Ahura Mazda is supreme. But in time, they contend equally. And this is a challenging religion. Choose you today whom you would serve, the God of Light or the Lord of Darkness. This choice you make, sooner or later. You could really get up a good altar call out of Zoroastrianism. And it's where the Jews got their concept of the devil. I think in Chronicles, it says that Yahweh stirred up, was it David, to number the people? That's before they had a devil concept. After the captivity, when they edited Kings in a parallel passage, they say, and Satan stirred up David to number the people. Now they had a personification of evil. Christianity gets its dosage partly through Judaism, partly through Mithraism. Mithraism was an unorthodox offshoot of Zoroastrianism, and it appealed to men, no women in the churches in Mithraism at all. It's a strictly male lodge. It's a fighting religion. It makes a hero out of the invincible sun. In Latin, Sol Invictus, the sun victorious, who symbolizes the hero that killed the mythical bull and accomplished a great deal. In Mithraism, you're not under the blood of the lamb, you're under the blood of the bull. And very literally, because when you wanted your supreme sacrament, this is valid as your passport to eternity right then and there, only it's expensive, you buy these vestments and you get under a scaffolding and they haul a bull up above you and they cut his throat and you're drenched with his blood. You're under the blood of the bull. You're under the blood, very literally. And you're buried in these vestments with the dried blood on them, and this gets you through fast. Mithraism was the favorite religion of the Roman legions and was the principal competitor of Christianity under the early Roman Empire. And Christianity borrowed directly from Mithraism and got Zoroastrianism indirectly through Judaism. That's where we get our devil concept. You see, the principle is right. The personification is wrong. There is a contest. God has set a problem. Only his opponent is not a person. His opponent is a condition. Energy matters dominant. Now what are you going to do about it? In the case of man, they make the observation that the human mind is safe, perfectly stable and safe, under two extreme conditions. Very primitive and very civilized. But the danger is in the intermediate stages. Under primitive conditions, man is too busy to get into mischief. He's in bondage to nature. It's a hard scrabble. And Don Infanta had no time for daydreaming and wasting time. This was a big job to feed their family and to stay alive. To use what tools they had, the primitive tools they had, just to make the grade from dawn to dusk each day. Now, in the ages of light and life, when people really are working hard to do God's will, where mind is spirit affiliated, that mind is stable. But it's in the in-between era. When we liberated ourselves from the crushing pressure of bondage to nature, we've got a surplus of food. Then we get cholesterol problems. We count calories now. Now's when we can get into trouble. We have divorced ourselves from mechanical dominance. We have yet to accept spirit guidance. And now is when mind can really go to hell in a handbasket. These are the dangerous. This is the transit of mortal mind from a safe harbor to the thrilling challenge of the open sea. And there's a sandbar at the harbor's mouth, and many a ship is wrecked on that bar. That would be a good
call. That's all the time I've ever heard.
Yeah. Shoot.
Would be Mithraism part of where Christianity got its part in that through the blood of Jesus that you are?
No, that Paul invented that independently.
No. Okay.
But it would appeal to the Mithraists.
Yes.
We get Sunday from the Mithraists.
It was a popular religion in Rome.
You see, the early Christians, like the Jews, held Saturday. The Mithraists held Sunday. And if I recall, December 25th was a high and holy day in Mithraism, before Christ. So you know where our Christmas came from. Christmas is a combination of the holy day of Mithraism, the Roman Saturnalia, the big blowout, and the Teutonic legend of you go into the forest and there in the dead of winter under the magical fir tree is the magical gift. the sword that you need for your crusade, you know, or something like that. It's a meld of those three, those various legends. Let's take the world today. Human mind has done a pretty good job. I never take off in a plane or see a big jet take off. I'm not thrilled. So many times I get the same flashback. I see one of Andon's remote successors chipping flint with stone to make fire. And that's where it all started, right down there. Or I see Andon tying a stick onto a stone and adding to the leverage of his swing. First tool, the first multiplication of human muscle power. That's where it all started. And I feel real, real proud of being a member of a race that can build these devices. Now, if we had affiliated our minds with spirit, we'd have it made.
Can you do that for me?
Ma'am?
Can you do that for me?
I sure would help.
Well, is that... I don't know.
But I don't think we can help Khrushchev.
No.
That much faith in prayer I don't have.
That is what I mean. Yes,
I think that's good.
Well, I don't.
Worship is even better. Prayer asks for something. Worship asks for nothing. Worship is a word which means love. Only the peculiar love which a creature has for a creator. There is no element of ego in worship. Prayer is great. Worship is greater.
No element of ego in worship.
No. Now, what you ask for may be an ethical request. Your prayer may be, you may say, dear God, dear Father. I often say, dear boss, make me more serviceable. And probably the answer to that prayer is the darndest kick in the pants I've had in years. Because I need to be jarred up to become more serviceable. And he answers my prayer. You know, when you pray a prayer like that, you are signing sight drafts on yourself. And don't think you're seraphim won't catch you. Yeah.
But I thought we
were... That's a terrifying thing.
I thought we weren't supposed to please.
You can ask for anything ethical. Father, make me more loving. Make me kinder. Make me more understanding. Make me more useful to my fellow men. Make me more serviceable to you.
What's not?
And I'm sure that, listen, those prayers got to be answered, if you mean them, because that's what he wants. And when a creature wants the same thing that a creator wants, there is nothing that can stop that, except time. Your answer may be delayed, but sooner or later you'll get that answer. It may not be in this lifetime. This I believe. Those prayers are answered. Just don't expect the answer today. Like the little girl that prayed for a doll. She didn't get one. And her friend says, well, God didn't answer your prayer. Oh, yes, he says, he answered. He said, no. Ethical praying is always answered. Selfish praying, never. Now, again, let's clean this up. It's like our thing meaning value. Prayer is psychological as well as spiritual. You're conscious of praying. You're not always conscious of worshiping. In fact, I think the highest form of human worship we're really unconscious of. The soul is worship. But prayer being psychological, if you can pray sincerely in an unethical way, which is an attempt to practice magic, dear God, if you'll only let me get this contract with this particular outfit, I'll give up this and this, and I'll get to church and all that. The fact remains that if you do this honestly now, you, you don't realize you're practicing magic. You're perfectly sincere in that prayer. This is a hell of a good way to mobilize your human faculties. And you may answer your own prayer and give the credit to God. So it's not... praying mobilizes you as well as affects the universe. Yeah, I think if a salesman prays to get an order, if he can pray on that level, of course it's a very common thing, I think he's probably a little better equipped to get the order, but I don't think God has anything to do with it. I think he has done a better job of getting his own ducks in line. I hate to hedge everything I say, but it's a complicated thing when you deal with a person. You've got overlaps in gray areas. Our minds today have come a long ways. When did we break the old barrier? About 1830, wasn't it? When we got locomotives? Up into Lynn, we couldn't go any faster than oats would take us in a horse. I call that the oat barrier. Now, within 150 years, we cracked the sound barrier. This is real progress now. Are we happy? Have we got tranquility on the face of the earth? Are you really sure that Oklahoma City will be here a year from now?
No.
I'm not so sure Chicago will be there a year from now. Yeah. We're scared, aren't we? Out in California, I had a chain of thought triggered by an awfully nice gal out there in the society. She's a practicing attorney. And she's a kind of a tough-minded gal. She said, you know, there's one thing that bothers me. She says, how can we make ever inherit the earth? I said, the answer's simple. They're the only people that could keep the inheritance. I said, Jesus never said that they shouldn't be strong. We tend to invest meekness with weakness. He was meek, but he was a very formidable looking guy. And on one occasion, when he had to, he held a human being off the ground till he wore himself out to stop the assault on the girl. He wouldn't hit the guy. He lifted him off the ground. How strong was he? When the strong are not meek, you have the story of Assyria, Sparta, Prussia, you name it. Sooner or later, strength without meekness begets fear. Those who are not strong become fearful. When those who are not strong become sufficiently fearful, they form a confederation, and they destroy those who are strong without being meek. But if a nation were strong and meek, they would inherit the earth, because their strength would make no one afraid. If the Russians were the greatest Christians that the world had ever seen, if they were threatening no one, if they were outdoing us in the good that they were trying to do to less privileged people, we wouldn't be afraid, would we? We would be spurred to emulate. But we're scared. The same thing that's going on in a man is going on in the Supreme Being. There are many analogies. A human being is dependent on permanent growth to construct a stable energy system. And the nucleus of that energy system is the thought adjuster, a spark of infinity, a fragment of God, an entity of absolute stability. I use the word absolute without any reservation. This is not ultimate stability. This is not transcendental stability. This is not maximum finite stability. This is absolute stability. Stable in the same sense that God the Father is stable. Because this is a piece of God the Father. You know, if one of us doesn't survive, our seraphic guardian will stand trial. But that father fragment is never asked to account, because everyone knows that the ministry of that fragment will be a ministry of flawless perfection. I mean, God is just flat exciting. And I would say he's the most unstuffy being alive. I hesitate to say he's got a sense of humor, but he has qualities of being which on the creature level registers humor. He has something which is ancestral to the spirit of adventure. At least when that quality shows up in folks like us, it is adventure. The willingness to take a dare, to accept a challenge. Judas was a faith adventure with Jesus. That master psychologist had no illusions about Judas. He took a chance, demonstrating God's willingness to take a chance. I don't think he had any illusions whatsoever about the chances on Judas. He made book, and the book didn't look good. He says, all right, I'll fellowship him anyway. And right to the end, he fought to save him. But when Judas passed the point of no return, he kicked him out unceremoniously. He said, Judas, if that's what you have in mind to do, go now and do quickly. Going back to the Supreme, what is like the adjuster to the Supreme Being, the Paradise Trinity? The Supreme is not a creature, the Supreme is deity. And the Paradise Trinity is the deity unity of absolute stability. Now, the Supreme is never going to fuse with the Trinity, as we will with the adjuster. But the Supreme is going to constitute the Trinity, the nucleus of the deity system of the organism that he's evolving. Think of the grand universe, especially the seven super universes, as a living organism. And think of the Supreme Being as the evolving personality of the living organism of time and space. Time and space, in a sense, is alive. And think of us as cells, volitional cells, floating in that living organism, being bathed with its nourishment. That's why we grow. He's evolving. We're participating in his evolution. And the papers tell us that that which we accept is par for the course and going on forever, someday will stop. When he finishes his growth, that's the end of evolution, and we know it. The end of finite evolution, the end of finite experience, and the beginning of something super finite. The Supreme Being is God's way of finding out what it would be like to be finite. Honest to goodness, finite. The Supreme Being has a beginning. Someday, we could get the number in terms of our year. It would be a boxcar number, but it could be written. And they could say, now, that's as old as he is, and if you go one more year back, he wasn't there. This is an origin, not a hypothetical origin. This is an origin just as much as we were born on thus and such a day and thus and such a year. If you go back one year before that, we weren't even conceived. We were pure potential. In the Supreme Being, God finds out what it's like to grow and to struggle, because the Supreme Being can be defeated in detail, but not in total. Actuarially, he's going to make it. But that doesn't mean that any individual connected with him is going to make it. You know, there's a difference between a medical opinion and an actuarial thing. If you wake up in the morning with a pain in your tummy that's a new revelation on how bad you can hurt, and you stagger across the lawn to your next door neighbor, who works for Aetna.
And you say, George?
I feel terrible. Am I in danger?
He said, how old are you?
I'm 39. He said, I've got a thing to worry about. Life expectancy of your age group is less than such. He said, but does this apply to me personally? Oh, he said, I wouldn't have the least notion. You want an M.D. Now, there's a place for an actuary. There's a place for an M.D. Actuarially, the evolution of the supreme is inevitable. But individually, it's up for grabs. With every free will creature. The papers point out, Jesus has never done wrong, but he has the power to choose evil if he wanted to. He has that freedom of choice. He's a free will being. So when he chooses virtue, that is a virtue. That's not a forced choice. He could choose the other one. No Mike Hill son has ever failed, but they all could. So the adventure each one takes is a real adventure. When Lucifer rebelled in our local system, what did they do? They isolated the system, didn't they? What happens in a human body when you get a local infection? Leukocytes come down there and wall it off. Now, they don't need to protect God from Lucifer. God is infinite, but they need to protect the supreme being from this infection. He's not infinite, he's finite. In the present universe,
right now.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, Bill.
You know, we're getting so deep into some of these papers that you got to be like a sea lawyer. And you've got to put down small print now and say this statement applies only in thus and such a condition.
And you have to talk a lot of punctuation.
That's right.
Certain people.
I'm still winning most of my arguments with Berkeley, but it's taking longer each time.
But actuarially, you're saying.
The Supreme Being is struggling. In a broad sense, and the papers use this. If you want to think of God as our father, then in the evolutional sense, the Supreme is our mother. We are born in the womb of time and space, and that is the Supreme Being. We are fabricated out of the raw potentials which he has cooked to the point where they can be used by finite creatures. Inside of you, a soul is growing. Now, you don't get something from nothing. Where does the stuff come from that this soul is growing out of? The potentials that are suspended in the Supreme. It's like raw wool. The adjuster spins it into thread and then proceeds to pull the warp out of the material mind and then infuse it with his spiritual weft. And that is the definition of Mirage. A mix of the material and the spiritual. To every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. If you stand on the floor and pick up a chair, then your feet push down against the floor just as hard as your arms lift up, don't they? Let's let the chair symbolize a problem which any one of us is solving. It's a moral, spiritual problem. What we get out of solving that problem is the enhancement of our muscles picking it up. What the Supreme cashes in on is the down thrust of our feet against the floor. That registers in him. The mechanics, through the adjutants of worship and wisdom, into the creative spirit and from her to him. And if we are victorious, he has inched one infinitesimal mite more toward reality. And if we are defeated to that same infinitesimal amount, he shares our defeat. What we as creatures do in a small way, Jesus, as a creator, does in a much larger way. And so do his brothers, his paradise brothers, and all other beings. As they whip their larger problems in time and space, this generates sovereign power. I want you to think of all these beings as being like little springs, some small, some large. And from this spring comes the freshet that converges by the terrain of the land into a brook. And then these brooks flow together into a small river, which is the tributary of a larger river, which finally becomes a great river. All of this converging. And the mouth of that river is the Supreme Being. That's exactly the way his sovereign power is building up through the small and the large successes of the creators and the creatures in time and space. This is the inflowing, converging power of the Supreme Being. And to me, a river system is the simplest way of thinking of it. We are drops of water falling like rain. Each one of us a drop, adding a little bit to this river. A creator sun would be more like a spring, starting an independent brook. What's up there and how is it working? Well, a long time ago, and I've actually worked out the mathematics, I'll tell you how many years ago I think it was. It's on the magnitude of 40,000 trillions of years. They give us a ratio in here, and you can work out a magnitude figure, which I don't think is stupid. I wouldn't try to defend the number in detail, but it's a big number, and it's 40,000 trillions. I don't think it's 40,000 billions, and it's not 40,000 quintillions. It's 40,000 trillions, or quadrillions of years. Sometime back that far ago, there appeared in Havana a spirit presence. We're told it is a symmetrical and beautiful spirit presence. And a year earlier, it wasn't there, and then it was there. This spirit presence comes from the Paradise Trinity. And this is the emerging spirit person of the Supreme Being. And I think for a while, that spirit presence was in Havana, and there wasn't anything out here yet. That spirit presence produced some changes in Havana. For example, we're told that the seven master spirits created the seven spirits of the Havana circuits in response to the request of the Supreme Being. He wanted them there, so they produced them for him. There may have been other changes. That's the only one I can think of. But then one day, the first local universe was started, like this. And of course, before that ever happened, the super universe personnel had come out and gotten their ducks in a line. The seven capitals of the super universes, the 10 divisional capitals in each super universe, the 1,000 minor sector clusters in each super universe. And then a greater sun came out and started the first of the local universes. And for the first time, it began to rain. And this river system began to collect. Are you with me? And when that flowed in, they tell us where the mouth of the river is. The mouth of the river is at the pilot world of the outer Havana circuit. These circuits don't have capitals, but they have pilot worlds, where specialized circuit services are located. That river terminates on the pilot world of the outer Havona circuit. And the minute that river began to flow, the third person of deity made a contribution. You know, he's the source of mind. And right then and there, he gave the supreme being mind. And it was this mind, coming from the infinite spirit, which unites the almighty, sovereign, evolving power of the supreme with the spirit person of the supreme. This is power, personality, synthesis, the putting together of sovereign power and spirit personality. And as he synthesizes, he grows. Now, the supreme is not a kept woman who is taking life easy and cashing in on the efforts of everybody out here in time and space. He's got his coat off and his sleeves rolled up and he's working at this. He's got an emerging purpose. He is slugging away at these finite problems. And they are just as big to him as our problems are to us. Sure, he's deity. But he's coping with the total problems of the total grand universe. We're coping with the total problems encountered in one human life. I think the challenge is proportionate in magnitude. We grow in him, he grows in us. There is a difference between our relationship to God and to the Supreme. And this forever ends the argument that Martin Luther had with the Roman Church about which comes first, faith or works. With God the Father, you believe. With God the Supreme, you produce. If you love God, you're his son. That's all he asks for. But the Supreme doesn't even open up a ledger account for you on that basis. He says, what have you done for me lately? That's said beautifully in the paper, and I want to get it exactly the way it is there. With God the Father, sonship is a great relationship. With God the Supreme, achievement is the prerequisite to status. One must do something as well as be something. Yeah, 1260. It's the sentence which introduces the paper. 1260, paragraph one. I like that. There are two standards of measurement in the universe. See, God the Father doesn't need our action. He is. But the Supreme Being is dependent on our action. He isn't yet. When you recognize the Supreme, you add something to your religious philosophy of life. This is the recognition of cosmic morality. Your moral obligations to the evolution of supreme deity. You owe him something. Because in the same sense that God is your father, the supreme being is your mother. And the papers use exactly that terminology. I find the supreme being a very exciting concept. It's foreign to our conventional theology. It's a hard concept to get used to. I found it in literature. But if speculative theology proposes a finite, evolving God, then they eliminate the infinite God. They have one or the other, but not one and the other, as I find them in this book. I like the two. together. Makes a lot of sense. The Supreme Being compensates God for God's otherwise inability to know what it would be like as deity to experience birth, gestation, growth, and maturity, because God is unchanging. But through the Supreme, he can know what this would be like to deity. Through the Adjuster, he knows what it's like to creatures, but we're not deity. We're going to go to paradise, and someday we're going to meet God. We will perceive that this is God. That is a tremendous experience. It's minimum perception, that's all. It's our initial contact with the Universal Father. We're going to meet him many, many times. And each time we stand in the presence of God, we will understand a little more. But we will never understand all of God. But someday, we will understand the Supreme Being. Yes.
How well will we know God on the finite level?
We'll know him through the Supreme.
No, we're just fine outers. We're not a seven-stage fine outers. We're six-stage.
We will have an augmenting grasp of God on the finite level, which will become final, I think, when the Supreme emerges and we become seven-stage spirits.
Well, let's say we're at the top of the firehouse, the first floor.
Yeah.
We're six-stage. We're right up against the roof.
No, we're not yet. Quite.
We're hanging down just under it like a fixture. I wondered how...
Much better we get acquainted with him on the finite level.
I tell you,
J.B.,
we're going to be circuited with the Supreme
when he emerges. And that's going to consummate our comprehension of God. We're missing a qualitative achievement.
That's going to what?
We're going to be partly encircuited with the Supreme.
Oh, you used a word that starts with C-O-N.
Consummated. Consummated.
Close it?
Consummate.
Finish?
No, on the finite level. You can finish finite things because they have limits.
We will
comprehend God as a finite. God projects onto the finite level. That projection we will someday understand, because we'll understand the Supreme. And through the Supreme, we will comprehend the finite aspect of the Universal Father, which instantly leads us into the superfinite aspect.
Now, Bill, we're six-stage. When we become seven-stage, we're on the bottom floor of the second floor.
We're going through the floor of seven-stage spirits. We're becoming first-stage something else.
Yeah.
That always works out that way. When you, as you cross the goal line, you discover you've entered another playing field. Only this one's bigger. Yeah.
More huge.
We will understand the Supreme because he is comprehensible. If he has a beginning, does that make sense to you? He has a growth period. He has a completion period. This makes a lot of sense to me. And of course, his completion isn't his end. It is a new beginning for him, too. The papers teach us, we've used our firehouse example. have used our firehouse. Example, a three-story firehouse with a pole running down the middle. You know the one they slide down on? That pole is the personality of the Universal Father. Because God is contactable on each of these levels. And it's the same pole. Symbolically, we can give this firehouse dimension. If the first floor is 2 inches high, the second floor is what, we're at 1,600 miles?
16,000 miles.
Or 32,000.
16,000.
1,600.
1,600? Yeah.
Well, I just got an The second hour. Floor, then, is 1,600 miles high. The third floor has no roof. It goes up. And that's a pretty good symbol. The first floor is the finite level. The second floor is the transcendental level. If we can get on the second floor, and we will, then when we hit the center pole, now we're attempting to know God as a transcendental ultimate being. Now we're attempting to know God on a level where God is omniscient, omnipresent, omnipotent. These are transcendental attributes of God, ultimate attributes.
Do we always recognize this supreme being as finite, or do we confuse him with God?
No, we know who he is. He is God the brother. He is God our brother. He is the brother of all creatures. The papers teach us that you discover the love of the Supreme in other people. The circuit of love is from the Father to the creature, and from a creature to other creatures. And to us, fraternal love is the essence of the love of the Supreme Being. The Supreme Being is the deity brother of all creatures. In much the same way that the Eternal Son is, in a sense, the elder brother of all creator sons. We will understand the Supreme as Jesus knew the Father. Because we are flesh of his flesh, we are bone of his bone. We are like him because we grew up within him. He is the womb in which the embryo of the finite creature is growing. And when we stop being embryos, we will be more than finite. It's a good way of looking at it. He's just as interested in breaking through to the second floor of the firehouse as we are, because there's growth ahead for him too. Only on the second floor, he is an emerged being. He knows he is known. It's a different kind of growth. He is now growing. He's now as contactable as the Infinite Spirit. Yes, he has. Yes, he has. In many ways, I compare the emergence of the Supreme Being. Now, this is not homologous, but it's analogous. Mike Gill's consort down here, the creative spirit, is not a clear-cut person as Mike Gill is. As she progressively forges out this universe, collaborating with the Creator Son, she's becoming more and more personal. There are degrees of augmenting personalization. And I think she's going to become a completely personal creator when she's finished her work. Like the Supreme will emerge as a contactable personality when he's finished his work. As the Infinite Spirit emerges in eternity, simultaneous with the completion of his work, which is the eternity production of the central universe. We were talking about it yesterday. Of course, let's be silly. It's in our ridiculous analogies that we understand. So let's go back to Genesis and say that it took a week to produce a bona. And they started on Sunday and rested on Saturday with the good Orthodox Hebrews. On Sunday, the infinite spirit is not a person. And by Friday night, the infinite spirit is a person. A bona is done. And the infinite spirit becomes a little more personal on Monday than on Sunday, and on Tuesday than on Monday. And on about Wednesday, they created life. They finished out the physical fabrication. Parallel with what we read. Only you can't see it with a spirit because it didn't happen in time sequence. But had it happened in time sequence, I think it would parallel this. And there are two examples in the papers when they are discussing events that are on the verge of Havona, the duringness of the appearance of Havona. And they speak of the infinite spirit as an agency, not an agent. I think that's a significant distinction of terms. An agency is not exactly a person. The Supreme Being is compared to Jesus. They tell us that Michael constructs the bridge over which we travel, going from our world to paradise to find God. The Supreme Being is constructing the stepladder that will take us through the ceiling of the first floor of the firehouse. And on his stepladder, we'll follow him onto the second floor. Jesus is the bridge from man to God. The Supreme is the bridge from the finite to the transcendental. What do you suppose transcendental growth is going to be like? Let's talk about personality. The papers tell us that God has given us a personality with some very tremendous capacities, some of which are completely dormant at the present time. In other words, if we weren't told they were there, we nor anyone else would suspect their presence. But the papers speak so flatly about it, I suspect that this is revealed information to the authors of the papers. Because when they don't know, they say so. We only know what we've been able to deduce. They tell us that a human personality has seven dimensions. And they're organized 3, 3, and 1. And they relate to the firehouse. On the finite level, we are engaged in expressing the first three dimensions of personality. And the seventh dimension has a certain function. It's totally. That's not its final function. That's its present function. It totals everything, unifies everything. If we can ever break through the ceiling, we're going to discover there are three more dimensions there. They're suddenly going to come to life. And that seventh dimension will still function as a totaling dimension. If we can ever break through the second ceiling, the one that's 1,600 miles high, then the seventh dimension will begin to function in its full sense. This seventh dimension of human personality has capacity to operate on the third floor. It can't ever take everything in on the third floor, but it can get there, and it can grow there. They call that capacity for sub-infinite penetration of the absolute. That's a lot of equipment, isn't it? And associated with this human personality is a spark of infinity, a piece of God. And I don't think you can lose that piece of God on any floor in the firehouse, because God's on all those floors. And it's just as much a piece of God on the third floor as it is on the second floor or the first floor. It's a sliver out of that center pole. That's the same pole on all floors. They give us this assurance. No matter what floor we're on, when we go to the center, we find the same pole. And the only difference is our capacity is changed. On the first floor, all we can see is God is finite. That's our limit, not his. On the second floor, we can see him as ultimate. On the third floor, we can begin to see him as absolute. It's the same God, only we have changed. We went with a bigger bucket each time, so we could bring back more of the comprehension of God.
So does this fragment within us grow as we reach these different levels?
It unfolds, that's all. Your personality will never change. Your adjuster, the original divine nature of your adjuster, will never change. But everything else within you will change. And because your personality will never change, you will always be you. You will look differently. When Mary first saw Jesus in the garden, she didn't recognize him immediately. It wasn't Jesus in a physical body. It was a visualization of a Maranatha form. But she recognized him pretty quickly when he spoke to her. When he walked out to Emmaus with the two boys that had heard him preach, it wasn't until he broke bread that they realized who he was, but they realized. Your recognition is not instantaneous necessarily, but it comes rather quickly. They knew Jesus in spite of the fact that his appearance was somewhat altered.
You had to go to the
Maranatha
level?
No, they brought the Maranatha level here. What they normally do on the mansion world, they did all on this world. They brought the equipment down here. It was very unusual. But then, of course, Jesus was unusual, too. Question,
likening our finite status, or likening ourselves to raindrops is compared to, say, the diameter of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
At the firehouse. Well, then the same sliver of God is within the raindrop.
Yes.
The only difference is the capacity with which it has been unfolded,
mm-hmm,
as the ascension is progressed.
Yeah. They tell us that this adjuster has eternal gifts for us. The adjuster, when we fuse with the adjuster, which means we have made an irrevocable decision to work for the boss. Fusion takes place. The adjuster immediately sets a smuggler's board that extends on out of sight and says, come and sup. He wants to give you everything he has, but you have only a finite tummy. You can only take so much off the smuggler's board and you're full. Now, you're going to go on eating on that smuggler's board for all future eternity. But you're never going to get to the end of the smuggler's board. So you're exploring God on the inside, qualitatively, while you're exploring God on the outside, quantitatively. And to complete one, you have to complete the other. The two are endless. It says, flatly, it will take the adjuster and the eternity of the future to complete the giving of the gifts he wants to make to you, which he brings from the eternity of the past. We got a real partner here. We got real equipment.
And we're given our basic help here at Mortal Dark is our thought adjustment.
Yes.
Which,
and other spiritual influences. But to me, the adjuster is so intriguing. It's an entity.
This is very interesting.
we leave these other spiritual influences behind, but the adjuster, gee, that's an eternal partnership. I call my adjuster partner. It's the name I have. I talk to this adjuster. I have never gotten a reply, and if I ever get one, it'll scare me on a 10-year growth. Because I'd be afraid of paranoia. You know what I mean? I wouldn't think I was spiritually endued in the inner man. I'd think this is the first step towards the booby hatch. But on the other hand, I've never doubted it was a dialogue. It's not the adjuster's fault that I'm stone deaf. I know it's a dialogue. I just can't hear the other end of it. And I don't expect to. Talk to your partner. Visualize a guy and a little boy in a zoo. This is a 3-year-old. He's been talking for about 14 months. Pretty good word flow. This is his father, his uncle, someone that likes the little boy. And the little boy is babbling away about the most inconsequential things that just don't mean much. But it's pleasurable to the adult because the little boy is showing the adult attention. Enjoyable to be told. And I don't know what the hell to talk to my adjuster about. But when we come to a strange town sometimes, I tell him about it. He doesn't have eyes. This is as pure a spirit entity as they come. I tell him what these cities mean here on Earth. I have no illusions about the weighty importance of what I'm talking about. I'm a little boy. But I'm showing attention. And this is good mechanics to do that. The important thing is you take time out. What you say isn't important. The intent is important. Tell him how good a steak is. If you want to. He's interested in you. And he is interested in your interest in him. This to me is the second greatest relationship in the whole universe. The only greater one is the relationship to God himself. And actually, there's no competition. You can't separate one from the other.
Yes, sir. Yeah. You don't separate one. If you're thinking to your father, just
you're talking to God.
And when you call him God, or when you call him partner, or what, that's correct.
He's your only mediator.
No, yeah. Mine is...
He's a telephone with a direct connection. It's a direct wire. When you talk in that phone, or to that phone, there's an infinite ear on the other end. That's the damnedest hookup, you know.
And you can't be too thankful.
No. We're equipped for eternity right now. We have all the equipment. We're never going to get a hill we can't make.
Look into low gear, see? We have the power to take any hill in time. We may not make it on the first crack. We may have to practice driving to get up that hill, but the horsepower is there. This is tremendous. And you can see, with this kind of equipment, you can see why the paper's closed. their last paper on God with that tremendous statement, "The portal of survival opens only in response to the free will choice of the free will son of the God of free will." Think of yourself in the zoo with a little kid, and how pleasurable it is to have a kid talk to you. And out of the mouth of a child comes nothing weighty or profound, but it's interesting to have him pay attention to you. And now you're the little kid, and don't worry about being profound or weighty. Talk to your friend. And if you get a reply, consult a psychiatrist.
Well, he did talk to one fellow. I wonder what he thought.
Oh, I think if they really wanted to talk to you, you'd know. They do it in some way that wouldn't scare you to death.
What do you mean by that? I don't know.
Oh.
I meant J.D.
Gabriel appeared to one person. Joseph had a dream.
Oh, yeah.
They have different ways of communicating. And if they know me, it won't be by anything that sounds like a voice. They'll pick some better
method. You mean we just go ahead and say weighty things like giraffe talking to each other? Leaves off trees, don't they, Uncle?
Yeah.
While holding anything.
Sure. Yeah. I sat down just for kicks, coming into an airport or coming into a railroad station. Maybe it's a town I haven't been here before. I told my partner all about how the town got started. What it means. I think for that, I don't talk about it. He'd like to take me around, tell me about where he came from. Why shouldn't I tell him about where I live? Might brighten up his sojourn.
Well, before we knew about thought assessment, we had thoughts like that. Who were we talking to then?
Man has always tended to believe in an alter ego that he could talk to. Even primitive people felt there was someone they could talk to within themselves. The concept of the soul, and even the adjuster too, is not strange. Hinduism comes awfully close to it in the concept of the Atman. The Egyptians had it cold in the Ka and the Ba, the soul and the spirit.
Yeah, but he knew what it was called, don't
you? Yeah, what's in a name? What's in a name? I don't think God cares whether we call him God, Boss, Allah, Amitabha, Amida, Lord, Elohim, El Shaddai, El Danai. How many names are there for God? He's never revealed himself by name. Father, of course, is the most meaningful. But that's a description of a relationship. Now, this is complex. It's not simple. I recall many years ago there was a very lovely English teacher in the Chicago group. And she said to me, why can't we, oh Bill, she said, why can't we have the Ten Commandments and the Sermon on the Mount, and why all this complicated thing? I said, well, I'll make you a deal. Let's just enjoy English and forget all about grammar and spelling and sentences. I said, I'd do it for you. God's plans are not simple, intellectually considered. Spiritually considered, they couldn't be more simple. Spiritually, it's all wrapped up in Jesus' very simple admonition. God is the Father of each man, hence men are brothers. and should act accordingly. That's all he talked about. Now, you can't get a religion more simple than that. You can say that in one sentence with seven columns, or three sentences if you want to be fuzzy. It's a short paragraph. Spiritually, this book is the simplest religion that's ever been presented. Intellectually, theologically, metaphysically, cosmologically, eschatologically, it's tremendous. It's very complex. But spiritually, no. Very simple. God is the father of each man. Hence, all men are brothers and should act accordingly. That says it, doesn't it? I think, pardon.
Well, the Bell telephone system ran out a movie on time on how they could decrease the interval of time back to the molecular structure of energy itself. And I thought this was an interesting analogy because the closer they got to stop time, the more complicated it got. And
yes. Yeah. Your car has an optimum cruising speed. And as you begin to go above that, your gas consumption rapidly rises. Not as new a concept as the Supreme. We've had the notion of the true light that lighteth every man that cometh into the world. Now, as to exactly what kind of illumination that was, there's been a lot of uncertainty. Was it the Holy Ghost? Was it this, the Comforter? What was it? But the concept of an actual entity, a detachment from God himself, which has got edges, you know what I mean? There is a place where the adjuster is, and then there's everywhere else where the adjuster is not. It is an entity that goes into partnership with man. This is a new thing. I think adjusters come down here with simply exquisite blueprints of a human life. Let's symbolize that by saying that a human life, the building of a human life, is like the building of a very beautiful house. And I think that the house which each thought adjuster has designed for our lives is a thing of rare beauty. Now, I think the adjuster's problem is to salvage. By the time we're 20, we've probably demolished over half the house by our damn fool decision. It's impossible to build a structure, so the adjuster is redesigning. Let's do the best we can with what we have left. By the time we're 40, the adjuster is probably settling for a storm cellar.
A damn cellar?
Yeah. But he's trying to make the best, most lovely storm cellar that can be built. We can't have anything above ground, but we can still have a good basement seat. And I think that crudely symbolizes very much of what happened. Now, if you want to compare notes, Jesus, I think, permitted his adjuster to build a life pretty close to what the adjuster intended. And you can see why I compare ourselves to storm cellar. But you can survive in a storm cellar as long as you let him build something, see, even if it's only a storm cellar. That's why, no, they penalize us in time, but not in eternity. Our damn foolishness holds us back, but doesn't stop us. Evil doesn't keep you from surviving. It's iniquity, deliberate sin, conscious disloyalty to God. That's got you stopped, then. That is the definition they give of sin in the papers. Conscious disloyalty to deity. You can have all degrees of evil. And again, if you're sincere, you wouldn't take a chance, would you? You wouldn't calculate minimal survival qualification. That's being shrewd and cunning. That to me connotes a lack of sincerity. Now, how little could I get? Could I make the grade on? Now, what you kick down out of sheer ignorance, for this, I think, it's not important. You just aren't going to have that beautiful house in his lifetime. You'd get it on the mansion world. But if you deliberately say, now, we'll start out with the idea of a storm cellar, I'm not so sure that that's a sincere attitude. What you do out of ignorance, Mary Catherine, you do out of ignorance. That's evil. And evil is a normal and expected part of human life. Ugliness, disharmony, damn foolishness. But not deliberate evil. Because that's not evil anymore. That's sin. Being cosmically awkward doesn't hold you back.
They'll have important while you're on the spring. How important your circle makes.
I was afraid someone would ask that. You know, in the finding of God, you go through the seven of all the circuits. Starting with number seven at the outer perimeter and ending on circuit number one in the inner margin. And you actually find God from the third circuit. There are certain levels of growth in a human life, and they have named them after this Avona pattern. When you become a bona fide human being, which means you have made your first moral choice, probably in about your fifth year of life, and you get a thought adjuster, you enter the seventh circle, and you grow. If you can make it to the third circle, this is a tremendous breakthrough, just as it is in Havona. The last two are more consolidating circles. Growth in these circles is not just spiritual growth. Spiritual growth is just one factor of circle growth. A person could be exquisitely spiritual and not have made very much progress in these circles. As I understand circle growth, this is total growth of the total potential of the human being. Intellectual as well as spiritual, social, even economic. It is maximum self-realization in the environment that you're in. The papers make this significant statement. Spiritual growth has nothing to do with planetary mortal success in life, but circle growth always does. I wouldn't use finances as a sole yardstick. One might be very successful with or without making a considerable sum of money. A great teacher might leave a rather small estate and yet be accounted by all as a great man. But we would recognize the magnitude of a circle grower. But a hermit might have a great spiritual experience, to use an extreme illustration. I think that the circle growth has to do with the Supreme. I think you are growing within the Supreme. and you are augmenting the supreme in the process, too. Whereas the feeling of sonship is your relationship to God the Father. Now, I don't think you can separate these. You can't have circle growth without having that sonship relationship. It is an essential part of circle growth, but it's not all of it. Circle growth means it's everything you are is in process of expansion and growth. You had a question?
Circle and cycle, would that be more same?
Not entirely. Circle means more level. They say that the growth of a human being is on 7 levels. That would be a better way. Jesus made the level. And if you stop and think of Jesus now, at about age 30, about the time he came back from Rome. Those last 2 years are getting a little fuzzy. Because remember, Jesus went through the equivalent of settling himself in light and life, which is why they tell us less about his last 2 years. He's outgrowing too far beyond us. But take it up to about when he said goodbye to Gain it and go into Cherith on the Persian Gulf. Think of that man. Isn't he tremendous? What a character he was. Think of the tact he developed, the social finesse that he had, the difficult things which he did so easily. The guy beating the hell out of his wife, and he said, "My friend, could I have a word with you a moment in private?" Jesus had jacks or betters in every hand that was dealt him. He had openers. And he did not learn how to play human poker just by worshiping God. He studied man as well. Jesus understood human nature as well as divine nature. He was a great psychologist. He was the greatest sales manager that ever lived. That what he put the 12 through was the greatest course in sales training that was ever whomped up on the face of the earth, on the job training. You figure how he cracked the nuts on Palm Sunday when he got into Jerusalem against the opposition of the Sanhedrin and everyone else. And he worked no miracles. He used nothing but he was a master psychologist. And he proved it that day. He walked in there and they were afraid to touch him. That's circle growth. When you consider Jesus the man, the things he could do, the abilities that he never half used. And people called him master of the business. They recognized he was great. And this they didn't do simply because he was out on the hill worshiping God. Jesus grew as a total man, not just the spiritual man. Now, let's not belittle the spiritual growth. That was there, too. And the circle growth could not have been achieved, I don't think, without the spiritual growth. But I think really what God wants of us is total growth. God in the broad sense of the word, both the Father and the Supreme. Make something of yourself. Use your equipment. Do the best you can. Don't bury it in neglect. I would love that parable about the big tycoon that took off and he left $5 million with one vice president and $3 million with another and two with another and $1 million with a third, with a fourth. When the accounting came years later, this fourth yokel had it in a safety deposit box all during the boss's absence. And what happened to him? He got fired, didn't he? He just flat got fired. Berkeley, when do we quit?
We have 30 minutes.
Do we?
Oh, why don't you go ahead on those if you don't make those circles.
Oh, you make them on the mansion wells. You make them sooner or later. You do your growing. this is the last life you can postpone washing the dishes in.
Yeah, I read in here, on the main well somewhere, that actually if you haven't raised a family, our children on this.
You'll have an opportunity.
Then you'll have an opportunity to do that.
With the Adamite children, sure.
But is it compulsory or is it, would it be?
That's
it
compulsory.
Is. Yeah, that's what I read.
Yeah.
Now you can, I speak of that because I have never had any children.
Well, you may still qualify. Lots of biological parents are going to be ruled out. They didn't raise the children.
Right.
Yeah. Shh, don't let that secret out.
What
was it little Willie said to little Tommy? Is your parents' house broken yet? No, it's the actual work you put in on the kids that count. I can see many a made man who's going to qualify parentally up there, and maybe one of the actual parents will make it. Probably Pa, who was away from home all the time. A person gets warning, he's going to fuse. And so he sends out engraved invitations. And all his friends go to the Marantia Temple, where you're behind a safe energy screen, because this liberates some physical energies and could be hurtful.